Good afternoon. I need to go back to what we were talking about 2 days ago to make a correction. When we were talking about literary assistants and we were talking about biblical writers who had literary assistants, we started in on Jeremiah, who had a scribe whose name was Baruch. And I am told that I unwittingly mentioned 3 times that Baruch was in prison. If I did, I was wrong. He may have visited Jeremiah in prison. I rather think he did. But I have seen no evidence that Baruch himself was imprisoned for whatever reason. And so since I made that statement 3 times by actual count, I want to correct it so that those who are listening to the recording today will know that 2 days ago I made a little slip and made it 3 times, which is causes great consternation. Our subject this afternoon is the integrity issue, what I call the integrity issue. Ellen White mandated vegetarianism on her church in 1863. It is reported that Ellen White required her church members to give up the eating of flesh food in 1863, but for another 60-some years, she herself in private was sneaking meat when nobody was looking and so on. And of course, if she was doing one thing and teaching something else, that does raise an integrity issue with the prophet. We're going to look at that this afternoon. As we mentioned earlier, Ellen White had 2 health reform visions before the 3rd one, which was the first major health reform vision. She had some messages in 1848 and I think 1854, the 3rd consecutive health reform vision was the major one of June 6, 1863. Now, this first major health reform vision was 18 and a half years after her very first vision. The Lord had a priority schedule of things that He was revealing to her. In fact, in my course in the seminary, I dealt with God's first 3 major priorities in the first 3 decades. In the decade of the 1840s, doctrine, getting our doctrines sorted out, was God's preeminent priority. That is not to say that that was the only subject of her visions or of her writings. It was not. But it was God's priority. Then, on Christmas Eve of the year 1850, she was given a vision on church organization. And then for a full 10 years, from 1850 to 1860, she got messages particularly on requiring us to organize our church, and the fact that it took 10 years of visions to finally get the first steps in organization indicates how much resistance she was getting when she was urging that. Now, she had other subjects of visions in the 1850s other than church organization, but that was God's apparent second priority in the decade of the 50s. Then in the decade of the 60s, the health message was certainly a very big priority. Now, in 1858, and this is found in Volume 1 of the Testimonies, page 206 and 207, some people have read the testimony that she sent to Stephen Haskell. Stephen Haskell was a very close friend of Mrs. White, and just an interesting arcane fact of minutiae, Stephen Haskell received more messages from Ellen White, letters and messages, than any other person outside the immediate White family. Stephen Haskell was the one who went to Australia in 1885. He got out there and he wrote to the Foreign Mission Board and said, "You must send Ellen White out here to help us. We need her." At first, she resisted the idea, probably because of age and possibly because of health, but they persisted, and she finally, in 1891, 6 years after Haskell went out, she went out to help them with the work and stayed 9 years. Now, Haskell was doing evangelism, I think, in New York City in 1858, and she sent him a testimony which dealt with the subject of pork. Some people have misread this. What she is simply saying in this statement, she wasn't saying it was all right to eat pork. Some people say that that's what she said. That wasn't what she said. You read it carefully. Haskell was making the issue of eating pork a test of church membership. And he said if you ate pork, you couldn't be a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, she was telling him that if he didn't want to eat pork, that was up to him. She had not yet had a message on vegetarianism or on pork. And she was simply telling him, she was not saying, as some people allege, that she was saying it was all right to eat pork. She didn't. She simply said that, Stephen, if you want to eat pork or don't want to eat pork, that's a private personal matter, but you are not to make it a test of membership. And incidentally, and this may surprise some of you, Ellen White said later on that the eating of pork, that is unclean food, Levitically unclean food, was not to be a test of church membership. Now, she starts out by saying, it is very clear that God instructed Israel through Moses that pork was not to be eaten. And she goes on to give several reasons why God gave that instruction. But she said, although that was a teaching of Jesus, it was not to be a test of the church membership. We call it a test of fellowship or a test of church membership. We'll come back to that in just a few moments. Anyway, the acceptance by Adventists in North America, as well as in other parts of the world, the acceptance of vegetarianism came comparatively slowly, and in some respects it is still. The acceptance of vegetarianism is a somewhat slow process. 138 years after Ellen White got her first message in 1863, got her first message telling God's people that they should not eat meat in general, but certainly in particular they should not eat pork. 138 years later, a survey was done, and it was done by a non-Adventist organization. It was reported in the Adventist Review of April 12, 2001, 3 years ago. And that report was a study of 406 Adventist congregations by a non-Adventist research organization called Faith Communities Today. And the results were presented there. And it was 49.5 or 49.6. It was just a hair under an even 50% of Adventists in North America who are vegetarians. In some other countries, it probably is substantially less than that. Well, during her lifetime, and still today, there were critics of Ellen White who accused her of devious duplicity and unconscionable hypocrisy in advocating, as they said, the non-eating of meat, in fact mandating vegetarianism upon the members of her church on one hand, while allegedly she consistently violated that counsel secretly in her own private life. So that's why I've called this the integrity issue. Now, this is not surprising in view of the statement with which we started last Monday, Selected Messages, Book 1, page 48, that the very last deception of Satan in this church is to try to do two things: to destroy her credibility as an authentic prophet of the Lord, and secondly, to create a satanic hatred against those writings, satanic in its origin, satanic in its intensity. And so if we see evidences of the attempted destruction of her credibility, of attacking her integrity, then we can understand clearly that that's part of Satan's plan at the present time. Motivation of Satan in all of this is very transparently clear, because, of course, if Satan can succeed in destroying the prophet's credibility, then you and I may be unlikely to read or to take seriously the counsels which she provided for the church. And if that happens, then Satan gets his way pretty much with the members of the church. So attacks on her credibility do need to be viewed in that particular light. Well, let's look at the whole subject this afternoon. I want to start with three allegations that have been made about alleged hypocrisy on the part of Ellen White's dietary practice. The first one was made by Dudley M. Canright. Some of you know who Canright was. Dudley Canright was the HMS Richards Sr., the George Vandeman, the William Fagel Sr., the Mark Findlay, are terrific, gifted preachers, all rolled up into one. He was probably the most eloquent Adventist minister in the 1870s and in the 1880s. He left us in 1887. Canright, after he left, wrote two books. The first book attacked our doctrines, and it was entitled Seventh-day Adventism Renounced, and he came out 2 years after he left the church, came out in 1889. The second book attacked the prophet of the church, and it came out either in the year of his death or the year after his death. It came out in 1919 and was entitled The Life of Mrs. E.G. White. I have been in evangelical Protestant bookstores in various places looking at what they have and particularly interested in what they have to say about Seventh-day Adventists, and I have been interested to notice that Canright's two books are still being published, attacking our beliefs in the one book and attacking our prophet in the other. Now, his book, in which the doctrines of the church, Adventism Renounced, that has been answered in print by a book by William Henry Branson. A number of years ago, in fact, I think when I was in the ministry, early years of my ministry, Branson, he followed J.L. McElhaney as General Conference President. William Henry Branson wrote a book which originally was entitled A Reply to Canright. But they gave it a bigger title, and the reply to Canright was in small print. In Defense of the Faith was the title of Branson's book. And he took Canright's book and answered at every point, one right after another. There have been other books that have sought to deal with Canright's attacks on Mrs. White. Now, what did Canright say? Canright reported that he saw personally James and Ellen White eating ham right in their own home. Well, I checked into this, and I found out that it is quite possible that he saw James and Ellen White eating ham in their own home, because you need to look at the historical context. First of all, Canright met James White for the first time in the year 1859. Very shortly after that, he was converted to Adventism. He was baptized by James White, and he became a welcome visitor in the White home. Now, that was 1859. It was 1863, 4 years after Canright was converted and baptized and became a friend of the White family. Not until 1863, 4 years later, after they had first met, that Ellen White was given her first health reform vision, June 6, 1863. And it was at that time, for the first time, that vegetarianism was recommended to our people, and pork was specifically singled out as a meat that really should not appear on Adventist tables. So, it is quite possible during those 4 years, from the time when Canright first became acquainted with James and Ellen White and was a guest at their dinner table, and when Ellen got her first vision dealing with pork, it is quite possible that during those 4 years, Ellen served ham on the family table. We don't know. But there is an explanation if that indeed turned out to be the fact. Yesterday we talked, the day before, we talked about Fanny Bolton and one of Ellen White's literary assistants who lied repeatedly and then confessed lying and wrote out handwritten confessions and so on. She claimed that she wrote Steps to Christ and some other things that Ellen White wrote, and then her conscience pricked her. We remember that she spent quite a bit of time, more than a year, in a mental hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Anyway, Fanny Bolton gave two reports that were of unproven veracity, and we'll look at those. She stated on December 12 of 1914, in a letter to a Mrs. E.C. Slauson, that one of our pioneer workers, Elder George B. Starr, who spent quite a bit of time working with James and Ellen White in their ministry, he was one of our well-known pioneers, that Elder Starr reportedly had discovered Ellen White in a Chicago railroad station restaurant, sitting behind, or hiding, as Fanny put it, hiding behind a protective screen. And Starr claimed that he saw, according to this report, that he saw Ellen White eating raw oysters with vinegar, pepper, and salt. Well, as soon as that thing surfaced, Willie White, Ellen White's son, who after the death of his father in 1881 took over his father's responsibilities as traveling companion and counselor and general factotum with his mother, Willie White wrote a letter to Starr. He was incredulous, but he wanted to get to the bottom of it. So he wrote a letter to Starr in the attempt to ascertain the veracity of this report. Starr promptly replied that the accusation was, and I am quoting Starr here, "the most absurdly untruthful lot of rubbish that I have ever seen or heard regarding Sister White. The event simply never occurred. Fanny Bolton's statement is a lie of the first order." So the person that she quoted himself said it didn't happen. Then there was a second story that she related that did have a semblance of truth. I'll give you the background in a moment, but first, what did she say? She said that on a certain rail trip at a railroad stop in a certain station in a certain city, that Willie White got off and returned to the train with, quote, "a thick piece of bloody beefsteak." And Sarah McInturfer, who was Ellen White's traveling companion, nurse, and girl Friday, Sarah McInturfer allegedly cooked it in the coach, the railway coach, and it was promptly devoured by the traveling party, including Ellen White. What are the facts? These are the facts. On one occasion, in the year 1884, there were about 35 Adventists traveling together, members of Ellen White's party and others who were traveling with them, about 35 Adventists. And they were traveling by rail from Battle Creek to Oakland. And for some reason, which I do not know and have not been able to ascertain, they traveled in what were called two skeleton sleeping cars, Pullman cars, which were attached to a freight train. Now, I would never want to travel like that. Freight trains go slow, you know. And the trip from Battle Creek to Oakland took many days before it got finally to Oakland. As the train, freight cars with these two skeleton sleeping coaches tacked onto the end before the caboose, as the train neared the Nevada-California border, they had been many days on this train, their food supply was understandably running low. There was no restaurant car attached to the freight car, the freight train, just these two skeleton sleeping coaches. And so they stopped at one railroad station, probably to refuel the engine, and their food supply was running low. And at this stop, Willie White got off the train, and he purchased 2 or 3 pounds of freshly killed ox. They believed that the animal had been healthy and that the risk of acquiring disease from eating it was slight. And by the way, at this time of year and in this particular place, fresh fruit was very, very scarce and very, very expensive. And Willie White, in commenting on this distorted report of Fanny Bolton, said, and I am quoting him, "For years, the White family had been vegetarians, but not teetotalers." What did he mean by teetotalers? Well, total abstainers. "They had been vegetarians, but not total abstainers." He goes on, "We had always reckoned that in a case of emergency, it was justifiable to eat sparingly of clean meats, Levitically clean meats." This instance that Fanny was talking about and that he is clarifying was 8 or 9 years before Ellen White decided, at the time of the Melbourne camp meeting in Australia, and let me see if I can give you the date for that. I've got it in here somewhere. Okay, the Brighton camp meeting was 1894. At the Brighton camp meeting, she felt at that time convicted that she should get rid of meat altogether, but for some reason she distinguished between what we call meat and poultry and fish. Now, you know, today, if you go into a restaurant and say to the waitress, "I don't want any meat," she may offer you poultry or she may offer you fish. I remember back about 1950, I was just 2 years out of college in the ministry, and the conference wanted to show its appreciation. Do you remember the ingathering campaigns? Harvest ingathering, sometimes called? Yeah, some of you do. Well, it was a fundraising program every year in which we went door to door asking people to contribute to our humanitarian program around the world. Anyway, the conference wanted to show its appreciation to those pastors who had met their goal. Now, I happened to have the good fortune of having a small congregation, and so our goal wasn't large. In fact, I think we were the second highest per capita, not in total dollars, but per capita membership in the conference. And so the conference had what was then called the home missionary leader. Some of you will recognize that term. It's personal ministries now. And so he took groups of five and six Adventist pastors in an area out to a nice meal at a nice restaurant. And I still remember, his name was D.R. Shireman. He's gone to sleep in Jesus years ago. And Shireman was kind of an interesting fellow. And so when the waitress came, he spoke as spokesman for these five or six Adventist pastors that he was entertaining. And he said to the waitress, "We don't eat meat." "Oh, that's fine. What do you recommend?" "Oh," she said, "we have some excellent baked salmon." "Madam, we don't eat meat." She said, "We have some great fried chicken." "Madam, we don't eat meat." And she responded, "Sir, fish is not meat and poultry is not meat." So anyway, Ellen gave up the eating at the Brighton camp meeting, gave up the eating of meat, clean meats. She gave that up at the time of the Brighton camp meeting, 1894, in Australia. But she still continued for a short time, quite a short time, continued to eat fish, and then finally she gave the whole thing up altogether. All right, Willie, going on in this statement, you will find in Sister White's writings several instances where she says, "Fleshed meats do not appear on our table at home." And this was true. During a number of years, when on rare occasion a little meat was used, it was considered an emergency. And when I started to do research on this back in about, what was it? It was 19, I retired in 1993, so it would have been about 1986, 87, right around in there. In fact, I wrote a small pamphlet, 30-page pamphlet, which the Pacific Press published. It had 80 footnote source citations, and half of those 80 footnote source citations had not been previously published. Bob Olson told me one time it was the best piece of scholarly work that I had done for the White Estate, doing something that had not been done previously. Anyway, I found, and we'll come to that in just a moment, I found that there were three categories of occasions when Ellen White would temporarily depart from her habitual practice of vegetarianism, temporarily to eat meat, and then would go back again, very shortly, to her habitual practice. Three different categories, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But let's look at this question of her teaching and her practice in terms of chronological sequence. First, the gift of prophecy was first given on an unknown day in 1844 to a 17-year-old Sunday-keeping pork eater, and the first vision never said anything about Sabbath being the right day to keep, never said anything about vegetarianism being the thing. The first vision, 17-year-old Sunday-keeping pork eater. As I mentioned a moment ago, God had a series of priorities, and the Sabbath wasn't the most important one, and health reform wasn't the most important one. Her first vision dealing with the Sabbath, incidentally, and the necessity of New Testament Christians to observe the Sabbath, would not come until April 3, 1847, and this was a full 7 months after James and Ellen had started keeping the Sabbath, not as a result of a vision, but as a result of reading Joseph Bates' tract in which Bible evidence was adduced that this was the thing to do. They read it, they said this is biblical, and they started keeping the Sabbath, and she didn't get her first vision about the Sabbath and its sacredness until 7 months after she had already been keeping the Sabbath. I mention this particularly for one reason. Some people, even some Adventists, I'm afraid, have the idea that we got our Bible's doctrines from the visions of Ellen White, and we did not. The doctrines of this church came from very careful Bible study. In fact, in my course in the seminary, I took a whole 50-minute class period dealing with the origin of our five most important biblical teachings and showing how each one of them came from Scripture, not from the visions of Ellen White. Our doctrines, friends, came from the Bible. They didn't come. She informs our understanding of those doctrines, yes. But she is not the origin. Her visions are not the origin of the doctrines of this church. Now, the first vision and the Sabbath came 7 months after they had already been keeping it in April 3rd of 1847. On health reform, she did get a little bit of information in 1848, avoid tea, coffee, and tobacco. In 1854, February 12, she got a little more information. It was a sort of an omnibus vision. It dealt with six topics, three of them dealing with health and three of them not dealing with health. But her first major health reform vision did not come until June 6, 1863, and that was 18 and a half years after her first vision. Health reform is important. And by the way, I can say truthfully that I'll be 77 next month. I am grateful for the Adventist health message. I am experiencing now fruitage from having observed, and I'm embarrassed to tell you I haven't followed it as faithfully as I should. And by the way, vegetarianism is one small part of the Adventist health message. It is not the health message itself. It's one small part, an important part. But there's a lot more to the health message than just vegetarianism. But one Wednesday night, on my way to prayer meeting, I was supposed to make the presentation that night. It was 6:30. We were headed for church. And I said to my wife, I said, honey, I am feeling extremely tense, and there's no logical reason for it. I said, I know my material. I'm not worried about not knowing my material and presenting it properly. I don't have any enemies that'll be in the congregation so that I'm tense because I don't want to face so-and-so because we've got a conflict between us. We were all friends, brothers and sisters in Jesus. I said, there's no logical reason, but I'm feeling tight inside my chest, and I'm feeling tense unusually. Well, we went to church. The Lord blessed the presentation, went home. I think I may have had a bowl of soup at 10 o'clock at night and then went to bed. 2:30 in the next morning, on a Thursday morning, I woke up and it felt like there were three steel bands around my chest constricting it. I went back to sleep, but at 7:30 in the morning, I felt that at my age, I shouldn't ignore something like this. Called the doctor's office, and his receptionist said, well, he has one empty period today at 12:30. It was his lunch hour. She says, you can see him then. So I went in at 12:30. The doctor's office was just across a little paved road from our county hospital. And when I came in, the first thing he did was put me in a wheelchair. And then he rebuked his receptionist for not having me come in at 8:30 when he came in so that he could have seen me immediately and didn't have to wait 4 hours. He checked me over and they wheeled me in the wheelchair over to the hospital emergency room. I was there for 2.5-3 hours. And then they wanted to send me down to Winchester, Virginia, 40 miles away, where they have a cutting-edge state-of-the-art medical facility, medical center, for heart catheterization. And they said, well, we can't take him today. All of our beds are full. Send him down tomorrow. So they admitted me into the hospital and started heparin to dilute the blood and everything. And I stayed there overnight. And the next day, ambulance took me down, and I had heart catheterization. And when the heart catheterization was finished, and I had come out of the general anesthetic, the cardiologist came to my bedside to talk with me before I was released to go home. He said, Mr. Kuhn, You have the heart of a much younger man. You have the blood vessels of a much younger man. You do not have, and so he attributed this tightness in the chest to possibly an indisposition, of maybe a digestion problem or something. And so he put me on Nexium, and he said, that'll take care of the problem. I had to check up with him. I had a checkup with him a few months later. And the last thing he said to me, Mr. Kuhn, I don't expect that you are ever going to need to see me again in your natural lifetime. Now, that's good news. By the way, his name was Dr. Gaither. Have you heard of Gloria and Bill Gaither? They're very big in gospel music. I asked him if he was related, and he said yes. He said all of the Gaithers in North America came from one family in Holland who immigrated to the United States. Well, I can personally testify, folks, that I am enjoying, even though the last 3 years, you know, this is my first camp meeting in 3 years. I've had a succession of medical problems. I've had two surgeries on a knee, total knee replacement, and further surgery on that. And this is my first camp meeting in 3 years. But in spite of some of these things that have kind of slowed me down a little bit, I am and my doctor, my family doctor, is a Roman Catholic. And he knows I'm a vegetarian. And he asked me the last time I was in, just a couple of weeks ago, he said, why are you a vegetarian? Have I mentioned this to you before? You know, I go so many places, I can't remember what I've said to who. I haven't mentioned this. Well, then I'll go on. I said, doctor, I'm a vegetarian for two reasons, health and religion, and they're in that order. I said, I would be a vegetarian even if I were not a Seventh-day Adventist, and I would, because of health issues. Mad cow disease and all of these other... Folks, the internet is full of information about meatpacking recalls of beef that have E. coli and a half a dozen other disease germs in them. It isn't safe. I mean, the newspapers report. When I taught at Pacific Union College back in the 70s, the press out there said pregnant women should not eat fish out of the Sacramento River. They're full of mercury and other heavy metals. It'll damage your fetus. And incidentally, I don't think I've mentioned this here. One day my wife was in the College Mercantile, which was a big store, grocery store, hardware. It had two bookstores, College Bookstore and Conference ABC. And she was in the section that had what we call health foods, meat analogs. And she was pulling down one tin after another and putting them in their cart. And there was a non-Adventist woman standing to one side watching her. Irene wasn't immediately aware of this. And finally, this non-Adventist woman came up to her and said, how do you prepare that stuff? And Irene said, well, there's little racks of recipes here on the shelves. And there are recipes on the labels of the various tins. There are two bookstores over there, the College Bookstore and the Conference ABC. And they have books on cooking vegetarian. And then she said, if you want to come to my kitchen, I only live a mile from here. I'll show you how I fix these things in my own kitchen. Well, the woman obviously was a little embarrassed at barging up to a total stranger and grateful for Irene's profuse help, and she felt she had to explain why she was interested. And she said, my husband and I live in Napa, county seat, 30 miles away from the college. We have become vegetarians. And then she explained, my husband is the chief federal meat inspector for Northern California. You know, the Department of Agriculture. And she said, he has become so distressed at what he has to put the USDA stamp of approval on, that he and I, we're giving... And folks, they aren't the only ones. There are dozens of meat inspectors working for the federal government who themselves have become vegetarians. Alarmed. You see, the government requires... Let's say that there's a cancer in this cow's carcass, and the carcass comes along, it's assembly line thing, and here's a cancer. The government requires the cancerous tissue be cut out, but the rest of the carcass goes through, totally ignoring the fact that the germs of that disease are floating around in the circulation system. And we learned that if the government required all the meat packers to discard the entire carcass of any carcass that had any disease in it at all, the meatpacking plants of this country would all close in 3 weeks. Politically, this would not be expedient. Meatpackers give good political donations to all of the political parties. And so they'd never get this thing through. They would be voted out of office very quickly by the influential meatpackers. Anyway, by the way, all right, Ellen White had her first vision on an unknown day in December of 1844. We do know the day of her 17th birthday. It was November 26. So within a week or two, approximately, of her 17th birthday, she had her first vision. Now, as a young girl, her health was very precarious, probably due in part to the tragic accident at the age of 9 when one of her classmates, playmate, threw a stone and hit her and rendered her unconscious, and that was the end of her formal education. She tells us about her condition as a teenager. In fact, the next 20 years, from 1844 to 63, tells us what her condition was, how they tried to remedy it. She said, "My condition," and I'm now quoting, "was weak and feeble. I was subject to frequent fainting spells. I felt faintness at my stomach, dizziness in my head, and loss of appetite, curiously, especially in springtime. Eating meat," tempted remedy, "eating meat removed for the time these faint feelings, and I therefore decided that for me, meat was indispensable in my case. I suffered keen hunger." She's open, honest. She says, "I was a great meat eater. It was thought that flesh meat would give me vitality, and this was therefore my principal article of diet as a teenager, from 17 on another 20 years. The result, however, while eating meat temporarily alleviated these symptoms, contrarily," she says, "instead of gaining strength, I grew weaker and weaker. I often fainted from exhaustion." Then she had this first comprehensive health reform vision, June 6, 1863. Ellen White characterized this vision as, quote, "great light from the Lord." She said, "I did not seek this light. I did not study to obtain it. It was given to me by the Lord to give to others. The Lord presented a general plan before me. I was shown that as God's people would receive this, their disease and suffering would be greatly lessened." And folks, are you aware of the new book that has come out? It's published by Oxford University Press. There is no more prestigious publisher in Britain or the United States than Oxford University Press. Its author is Dr. Gary... it'll come to me. Dr. Fraser. Dr. Gary Fraser, who is attached to the School of Public Health, Loma Linda University. And one of his jobs is to keep up copies of all of the current research on Adventist health and lifestyle and so on that is published not in the Reader's Digest, Time, Newsweek, no, that is published in scientific peer-reviewed journals. Most of it has been funded by either the National Institutes of Health, the chief federal medical experimentation organization in Washington, D.C., federal government, or by the American Cancer Society, American Heart Association, et cetera, et cetera. And on their website, if you have access to the Internet, you can look at this yourself. On the Internet website, they list, the last time I counted, it was at least 304, it may be up to 310 by now, scientific studies in peer-reviewed scientific journals on Adventist lifestyle. And the conclusion, some of it was done by scientists who were doing research. Some of it was done by the government of Norway and the government of Denmark. And the governments of Norway and Denmark studied Adventist lifestyle. And they decided and publicly said that if we could persuade everybody in Norway and Denmark to live like the Adventists do, or I should say like the Adventist program outlines, because not all of our people in those countries are following the health message, they said we could save substantially on our outlay of expenses for health care for the citizens of our respective countries. Anyway, Dr. Fraser has written a book, and it will cost you $60. It's the only time in my life I ever paid $60 for a book. And it is written primarily not for medical laymen, you and me, most of us, but written for scientists and healthcare professionals. And in that book, it's a big, thick paperback, a hardcover book. In that book, he gives the summaries of the findings of many of these scientific studies that have been done on Adventists. And by the way, are you aware that they are conducting a new health survey among Adventists at the present time? Some of you are nodding your heads, yes. We have, I think, 10 or 12 people in our church, including my wife and me, who volunteered to participate in the new study. Okay, she was given this vision. I was told that as God's people would receive this, their disease and suffering would be greatly lessened. And I was shown that this work would be progressive. The health message is not a static something, it is a progressive thing. Okay, what was her response? I accepted the light on health reform as it came to me. Since the Lord presented before me in June 1863 the subject of meat eating in relation to health, I have left off the use of meat. I adopted the health reform. I have not taken one step back since the light from heaven upon this subject first shone upon my pathway. I broke away from everything at once, from meat and butter, and from three meals a day. I came down to two meals a day. I at once cut meat out of my bill of fare. And the results? Interesting. My former faint and dizzy feelings have left me. Previously, I've had trouble every spring with loss of appetite. But last spring, I had no trouble in this respect at all. My appetite is now satisfied. My food is eaten now with greater relish than ever before. In 1904, getting on in years, age 76, I have better health today, notwithstanding I'm 76 years of age, than I did in my younger days. And in 1909, at the age of 82, she said, I still have had no occasion to change my mind. I have better health today, notwithstanding my age, than I had in my younger days, but not without a battle. All of the above results were not obtained without a severe emotional struggle. She said, in discontinuing the use of vinegar, she experienced a very traumatic struggle. She said, I fought the temptation, determined not to be mastered by this habit, that solely afflicted me now for many weeks. But in the end, I obtained complete victory over the use of vinegar. In discounting her formerly heavily laced flesh diet, she characterized the ensuing struggle as a special battle that she had to fight. Next year, 1864, I have lived for nearly 1 year without meat. 1869, 5 years later, writing to her son Edson, we have in diet been strict to follow the Lord, the light the Lord has given us. We have advised you, son Edson, not to eat butter or milk or meat. We have not had it on our table. Next year, 1870. I have not changed my course a particle since I adopted the health reform. I have not taken one step back since the light from heaven on this subject first shone upon my pathway. I broke away from everything all at once. Well, does this then mean that Ellen White never again ate a piece of meat? And the answer is no, it doesn't mean that. Did she ever attempt to hide this fact, as the critics of her day and ours have now fondly loved to allege? No. In 1890, she explained, when I could not obtain the food I needed, I have sometimes eaten a little meat. In 1901, she referred to certain instances following the abandonment of meat from her dietary in 1863, when I was compelled to eat a little meat. Actually, as I mentioned a moment ago, in my own personal research on this subject in preparation for writing that little pamphlet, which unfortunately is now out of print, in 1985 and 86, I discovered three categories of situations in which James and Ellen White temporarily would abandon what had become a habitual practice of vegetarianism, temporarily under one or the other of these three categories of situations, and then they would go back after a short time. The first category had to do with difficulties in travel. The second category had to deal with medical emergencies. And the third category had to do with the transition of a new cook for the White household. I will now present in detail some interesting facts about that. Extensive travel for James and Ellen White was a fact of life for the Whites in their far-flung ministry. And when they were traveling out in the field, they almost never stayed in a hotel. Now, I came up to your camp meeting, and they have put me up in a very nice motel that's 2.5 miles from your campus here. It's a brand new one, I guess. It looks new anyway. I don't think it was there when I was up here 4 years ago, the last time for your camp meeting. In fact, there's a lot of changes at that intersection. You've got a big store that sells outfitting stuff. I don't think that was there 4 years ago. So I didn't recognize the place when I drove up, but I'm staying in it's a budget motel, and I'm very happy for that because I want to save the church just as much money as I can. And when I do my own personal travel, we stay at inexpensive motels. We feel that the stewardship principle needs to be applied in practical ways. But when the Whites traveled in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they did not stay in hotels. They stayed in the homes of our church members. They seldom ate in restaurants, very infrequently ate in restaurants. They ate in the homes of their hosts, church members who were putting them up. And some of their hosts were poor and could not afford such luxuries in those days as fruits and vegetables. They had meat, and that was about all they had. And so there were difficulties encountered by James and Ellen White in the extended, also difficulties in the extended use of public transportation, particularly rail transportation. And then there were difficulties which often arose as a consequence of their being temporarily stranded in some isolated and extremely remote geographical regions, particularly the mountains of Colorado on two different occasions. For example, on September 2, 1873, Ellen White kept a diary, and her diary entry for that day finds her and James stranded in a remote place in the mountains of Colorado. Their carriage that they were riding in broke down, and they had to leave it right there where it stopped and send somebody 20 or more miles to try to find somebody who could come and repair it, and it took time. And they were consequently getting short on provisions, in her own words. As a result, one man in their party left camp to search for supplies to supplement their rapidly depleting larder. Meanwhile, a passing hunter gave them a small piece of a deer that he had killed 20 miles down the road and had carried on his back. And she said, "We made it into broth." And she said, "Willie took a gun and went and shot a duck." And she said, "It came in a time of need, for our supplies were rapidly diminishing." In those same mountains, 5 years later, same thing. They got stranded, got stuck. And Ellen advised her husband to fish and hunt, again, out of a similar necessity. Christmas Day, 1878, found them in Denison, Texas. The Whites invited a destitute Adventist family to join them for breakfast, which included a quarter of venison cooked and stuffing. "It was as tender as chicken," she remarked in her diary. "We enjoyed it all very much. There was plenty of venison in the market, though probably there was not very much else available in the market," for she immediately adds in her diary, "I have never seen in years so much poverty as I have seen since coming here to Texas." Then in 1895, she's in Australia, and she writes a letter to one of our leaders back in Battle Creek, whose name was Asa Oscar Tate. He was a denominational editor. And she reported on what was going on in Australia at this time, 1895. "I have been passing through an experience in this country which is similar to the experience that I had in new fields in America in the earlier decades of the 19th century. I have seen families whose circumstances would not permit them to furnish their table with helpful food. Unbelieving neighbors sent them in portions of meat from animals recently killed, and they have made soup of the meat and supplied their large families of children with meals of bread and soup. It was not my duty, nor did I think it was the duty of anybody else, to lecture them on the evils of meat eating when they had to eat whatever they could get. I feel sincere pity for the families who are newly come to the faith and who are so pressed with poverty that they don't know where their next meal is coming from. And by the way, I got a little glimpse of that myself. I have been to South America twice. I have lectured in three of our four universities. When I was down there, we only had three. Since then, they've added another one. But I lectured in our universities in Peru, in Brazil, and in Argentina. And when I got to Argentina, I got my eye open to something that I had just heard a little bit about, but didn't know much about. In Argentina, the beef industry is subsidized by the state government, the government of Argentina. So that puts the price of meat way down because the government pays the meat packers the biggest share of the cost. And so meat, this is not something I've ever found in North America, but meat costs less in Argentina than vegetables and fruits. And we have poor church members in Argentina who can afford to buy meat, but they can't afford to buy vegetables and fruits. Now, that seems so strange and foreign to you and to me here in North America. But that's the way the situation is because the government subsidized the cost of beef down there in South America. All right, second category had to deal with medical emergencies. While Ellen White advocated, for example, the avoidance of the use of tea as a beverage, and she did, as early as 1848, she raised the question of it not being suitable to drink. She did not hesitate herself to drink tea for a therapeutic necessity. Remember, they didn't have over-the-counter remedies in those days for headache, you know, Anacin and Tylenol, and you know, these various preparations you can buy over-the-counter, you don't need a prescription. And she said, in cases of severe vomiting, I take tea as a medicine, but not as a beverage. And in a sermon at Oakland, California, she told her congregation, once when crossing the waters, I was sick, seasickness, motion sickness, and I could retain nothing on my stomach. And I did take a weak tea as a medicine. And then she immediately added, she knew human nature. I don't want any of you here in the congregation to ever remark, Sister White uses tea. I do not use it as a beverage, neither do I keep it in my house. But she went on, if I needed it as a medicine, I would. Well, the same was true with meat. There were times when it was deemed a medical emergency, when the doctors came in and said, her niece, grandniece, May Walling, visited them in 1874. May Walling came and lived with her aunt and uncle, Ellen and James White, and she had pernicious anemia. The doctors came to check her over, and they told Ellen she needs to have some meat in addition to fruits and vegetables. And so Ellen went out and purchased, or had James purchase, a little bit of meat. She wrote to her son Willie a little later on, and she says that this was the only reason that we got it. And when May left us, went on back home, we no longer continued to have meat since. In 1894, in a Youth's Instructor article, Ellen White wrote, a meat diet is not the most wholesome of diets, and yet, are you ready for this? I would not take the position that meat should be discarded by everyone, 1894, not the year 2004. Those who have feeble digestive organs can often use meat when they cannot eat vegetables, fruit, or porridge. 4 years earlier, 1890, she recognized that certain emergency conditions might require emergency measures in treatment. And she said, in certain cases of illness or exhaustion, it may be thought best to use some meat. But even so, great care should be taken to secure the flesh of healthy animals. Then she immediately added this cautionary caveat. It has come to be a very serious question whether it is safe, and this is 1894, whether it is safe today to use flesh food at all in this age of the world because of the growing increase of disease in the animal kingdom. And she concluded by saying, I am becoming more and more afraid of the disease thing. In 1905, she wrote to an Adventist doctor. The doctor had inquired earlier of her as to whether it might be all right to serve meat to patients who were dying. And she wrote in 1905, Dr. So-and-so asked me if under any circumstances I would advise the drinking of chicken broth if one were sick and could not take anything else into the stomach. I said, there are persons dying of consumption, that's what they called tuberculosis in those days, who, if they ask for chicken broth, should have it. They're dying anyway. But, she went on, I would be very careful. This example should not injure a sanitarium's influence or make excuse for others to rationalize an unsanctified appetite thereby, to think that their case required the same diet. In a letter in 1896, the consumptives, tubercular patients, who are going steadily down to the grave, should not make particular changes in this respect with regard to vegetarianism, but care should be exercised to obtain the meat of as healthy animals as can be found. Persons with tumors running away their life should not be burdened with the question as to whether they should leave meat eating or not. Be careful to make no stringent resolution in regard to this matter. It will not help the case to force changes, but it will do injury to the non-meat eating principles. In other words, educate the mind, but force no one, for such reformation made under a press is worthless. Then there was an interesting third category. When Ellen White came back to the United States, she lived at Elmshaven in St. Helena, California, which is at the bottom of Howell Mountain. Howell Mountain, at the top of it, has Pacific Union College campus, I think 1,800 acres up there. Used to have 2,800, but they've got 1,800 now. Then halfway down the mountain is the St. Helena, used to be called Sanitarium and Hospital, St. Helena Adventist Health Center. And then at the bottom of the mountain, St. Helena, there is the Elmshaven Estate, where Mrs. White made her home the last 15 years of her life. And down in Elmshaven, they had so many visitors, it was not uncommon for 16 to 20 people to put their feet under Ellen White's table at any given meal. In fact, one time she mildly complained to, I think it was a daughter-in-law, and she said that, is it our duty to keep a free hotel? She was human. And I think she resented some of the duties. But anyway, 16 to 20 people, in addition to her own family and workers, putting their feet under her table, she had to have a hired cook and some other domestic help, as well as literary help, in order to keep things going. She could manifestly could not cook meals for such a large group of people. Well, at that time, most of her cooks came from young women who were students at the top of the mountain at Pacific Union College. But of course, these girls, after a few years, would leave school either to get married or graduate, and then they would have to hire another girl. Well, the problem sometimes was that the new girl did not know how to cook vegetarian. And so Ellen started to train her, but until she knew how to cook vegetarian, they had to eat what the lady knew how to cook. And sometimes that included meat. So this was a third kind of category that I have found in which temporarily the whites would temporarily discontinue their habitual practice of vegetarianism and temporarily have meat on their table. 1894, Brighton Camp Meeting. In 1894, Ellen White attended a camp meeting, and at this time, she felt the Holy Spirit prompting her to discontinue flesh foods, but not yet fish. Fish would go in another two or three or four years, but to discontinue flesh foods. And she went to the expedient of writing out in her own handwriting a pledge to her Heavenly Father that she would no longer eat meat. A little later on, fish would also be discarded. And I think by the time they came back to the United States, 1900, both meat and fish were pretty much things of the past. Now, what about shellfish? Now, I'm going to share something with you that I hope you'll hear me out completely before you come to a conclusion, because this may be a little shock to you. On May 31, 1882, James and Ellen White were living in Healdsburg, California, and they had just started a college, which was called Healdsburg College. In 1906, it would be relocated on top of Howell Mountain and be called Pacific Union College, where it would be my privilege to teach for 11 years, beginning in 1967 to 78. She wrote Ellen wrote to her daughter-in-law down in Oakland, because that was where our publishing house was located, and Willie was very much involved, and others were involved in the operation of that thing in Oakland. It was 80 miles away. And she wrote to Mary, Willie's wife, and included a shopping list of things to bring with her on their next trip to Healdsburg. Included was this request: if you can get a good box of herrings, fresh ones, please do. The last ones that Willie got are bitter and old. Oh, and if you can get a few cans of good oysters, get them also. Now, herrings, of course, are not considered Levitically unclean, but oysters are generally not used by New Testament Christians who are concerned about the Levitical cleanness or uncleanness of flesh foods. And although the Levitical ban on oysters today in our church is fairly well accepted without very much question among church members, evidence, historical evidence exists that the question of whether or not various forms of shellfish were permissible had not been settled within Adventism as late as 1882. We were very late in coming to conclusions about shellfish. In fact, the next year, 1883, W.H. Littlejohn, he was an author, a scholar, and newly elected president of Battle Creek College, and one of his little hobbies was writing a question and answer column for the Review and Herald. And somebody wrote in to Littlejohn's column, and they said, "Are oysters included among the unclean animals of Leviticus 11? And secondly, do you think it is wrong to eat them?" And Littlejohn replied, I think with a bit of hesitation, "It is difficult to decide with certainty whether oysters would properly come under the prohibition of Leviticus 11, 9 to 12. His own opinion, which he expressed in the column, was that probably they ought to be banned, but he refused to dogmatize at the time. They were still studying, as late as 1883, this question of shellfish, whether it came under the Levitical ban or not. Now, I've already told you that with regard to clean fish, Ellen White continued to use those for several more years after the 1894 Brighton camp meeting. Now, with regard to vegetarianism, Ellen White repeatedly said, "I have never departed from principle." And the critics say, "Ha, here is evidence that you ate meat here, here, here. You told the church to quit using it in 1863, and you were using it right up to 1900. Is that honesty or is that hypocrisy?" Well, she said, "I have never departed from principle." And I want to examine that with you, because obviously Ellen White did not consider vegetarianism a principle. Now, that opens up a can of worms that I've got to exhaust and explore with you. In T. Housel Jameson, you ever heard of T. Housel Jameson? Some of you are nodding your heads, yes. He had a lot to do with the establishment of this school right here. He may have even been principal. I think he may have been principal. At least he had a lot to do with the establishment of Blue Mountain Academy. That was 50 years ago, wasn't it? About that. T. Housel Jameson wrote an undergraduate college class room textbook on prophetic guidance that I used for years. I used it in our school in Africa, and I used it at Pacific Union College, and I used it when I was teaching overseas. In that chapter, he has a chapter dealing with what the theologians call hermeneutics. That's a fancy 50-cent Greek word which simply means interpretation. And he offers three rules of interpretation of inspired writings, whether it's Ellen White or whether it's the Bible, apply equally. The first rule is take all that the prophet has said on whatever subject it is that you're studying before you draw your final conclusion. If you just take one or two statements, you may go off on a tangent. The second one, and quoting Ellen White herself, who said time and place must be considered, you must consider in any statement both the literary context, what was said just before and just after, and the historical context, what was the background of circumstances which called this forth. Study the internal literary context and study the external historical context in some statements. And then his third principle is the one that concerns us here in this discussion here this afternoon. Every time this principle goes, Every time a prophet is giving counsel, he or she is doing one of two things. The prophet may be enunciating a principle. And principle in any dictionary is defined as an unwavering, unswerving, unchanging rule of human behavior or conduct. Principles never change. A principle yesterday will be a principle the day after tomorrow. Principles never change. It's an unbending, unvarying, unchanging rule of human behavior or conduct. Now, there are also policies, and a policy is defined as this. A policy is the application of some principle to a situation, a current, contemporary, contextual situation. It's the application of a principle. And unlike principles, policies may and do change as the circumstances which call them forth may change. You need to decide when you read a given statement of counsel from a prophet, biblical or Ellen White, you need to decide, is this a principle? Principles never change. Or is this a policy? Policies do change as the circumstances which call them forth may change. Now, on that basis, Ellen White did not believe that vegetarianism was a principle. She believed it to be a policy based on other principles, and a very important policy, but not a principle. Let me ask you this. Did they eat flesh food in Bible times? They sure did. How about Jesus? Did he eat? Oh, he ate fish out of Galilee. He ate lamb at Passover every year, and who knows what other occasions. Okay, if vegetarianism were a principle, principles never change, then Jesus was violating principle. And, you know, there are people today, and I've visited with some, who say, well, Jesus ate meat, so it's okay for me to eat meat. And come back and say, were the animals as diseased in Jesus' day as they are today? And, of course, the answer is no, they weren't. It wasn't as risky in Jesus' day. And this is one of the health reasons, folks. This has nothing to do with religion. This is one of the health reasons why I don't eat flesh foods. It's too risky. I don't want to bring those disease germs into my body and get sick. So vegetarianism was and is, for Ellen White and for me and maybe for you, vegetarianism was an important policy, an application of several principles, her principles on which she based the policy of vegetarianism were very, very important. I found three eternal, unchanging principles on which Ellen White based her policy of vegetarianism. Principle number one, the Christian's body is a temple for the indwelling of God's Holy Spirit, and man has a sacred duty, her words, a sacred duty to maintain this temple in the best possible condition, and man should not deceive himself into thinking that God will overlook without punishing any defilement of it. Paraphrase of Paul, 1 Corinthians 3, 1 Corinthians 6. Principle number two, this is a principle, this never changes. And the policy on vegetarianism was based on principle number two as well. Preserve the body in the very best condition of health. Preserve the best health. And then principle number three, do the very best possible under every immediate circumstance, seeking always to promote life and health and strength. In volume 9, she says, eat that food which is most nourishing. So Ellen White believed that as a policy, an inspired policy, she would not eat flesh foods, but it was not a principle. And so when she says, I have not departed from principle, with her definition of principle, she was speaking the truth and was not engaged in a hypocritical act, as her critics would like to say. Willie mentioned in an earlier statement that I shared with you, for years the White family had been vegetarians, but not teetotalers. In other words, total abstaining from flesh foods. In 1894, Ellen White was in Australia, and she got a letter from a non-Adventist woman who was very active in the temperance movement in Australia. And as you know, Ellen White was very active in the temperance movement over there and also in this country. And this woman wrote to her to ask about the position of Adventists when it came to temperance, whether or not they were total abstainers. And this is what Ellen White wrote in the letter. It's very interesting. I am happy to assure you, Mrs. Kavanaugh, that as a denomination, we are in the fullest sense total abstainers from the use of spirituous liquors, wine, beer, alcoholic cider, and also tobacco and all other narcotics. And we are earnest workers in the cause of temperance. Additionally, all Adventists are vegetarians, many abstaining wholly from the use of flesh food, while others use it only in the most moderate degree. And of course, she was acting on principle, she says, although the critics like to challenge her on that. Well, I've got 3 minutes. And as usual, I have more to say than I have time to say. Maybe this would be a good point to bring it to a halt. And if you have any questions, this will be our last time together. So if you have any questions on this or any of the other things that we have dealt with on the preceding 4 days, and let me say here that I have appreciated very much your interest, your patience, and your staying by to the end. We haven't had a lot of people get up and walk out in the middle, which is rather disconcerting to the presenter. I appreciate your interest, and I appreciate your interest in Ellen White, your desire to learn more about her, about this remarkable gift that's been given to our church. And so I just want to thank you, because this will be the last time I will be seeing you, probably for quite some time to come. Do you have any questions? Yes. He was the head federal meat inspector for all of Northern California. That incident was probably 1975 or 1976, because we left PUC in 78. So the closest I can date it would be 75, 76. It might have been 77, but I think 76. Incidentally, the lady never took Irene up on her offer to show her how to cook in her own kitchen, in Irene's kitchen. But since that time, I have seen reports that an increasing number of federal meat inspectors are themselves becoming vegetarians. Yes. She was very active in promoting it, and I personally feel that we have missed the boat just a little bit in allowing worldly, you know, General Foods and Worthington and, you know, some of these other companies that aren't Adventists to take it off of our hands. When my wife came to study at La Sierra College in 1947, 1948, that was her freshman year. That was my senior year. We're the same age, just a couple of months apart. But when she graduated from academy, she went to work for 3 years to help support the family. The father deserted the family, and her mother had 3 children. Irene was the oldest, so she was a freshman when I was a senior. Her freshman year, however, was her last year, even as that year was mine, because I proposed marriage on April 1. I often later joked that I chose that day in case I changed my mind. But I never changed my mind, and last year we celebrated our 55th wedding anniversary. But Ellen White was very active in this, promoting it. She was active in promoting health food restaurants, and we haven't done a great deal of that. I think in New York City we've had one or two, and I've heard of one or two other places around the country. But she was promoting that very, very strongly. In fact, I think there's a compilation of her writings that is available through the White Estate, dealing with promoting the preparation of these foods and the manufacture and the distribution and so on. Yeah, she was very much in favor of it. And folks, she had something to say about people who ridiculed those health foods, and she said, don't do it. She said, if you want to continue eating meat, that's your business. But she said, don't ridicule these health foods. And you know, there are people who ridicule, you know, I gave a piece of one of these linkettes to my dog, and the dog sniffed it and walked away. Or worse, lifted his leg. There are people who make jokes about the health foods. And I personally don't care for the ones that imitate pork, the wieners and some of the wham and some of the other ones. In fact, I sometimes kind of jolt some of these young kids that are serving in the cafeteria, and they want me to take a certain one of these health foods, and I say, no, that's image to the beast. But no, she had a lot to say in favor of. Yes.
Would you know where I could procure the testimonial of Wetzel and the 69 letters? I did listen to it once, but I lost it. Would you know? Do you know the story?
The testimony of
Wetzel, Brother Wetzel and the 69 letters that Sister White wrote.
Are you talking about the Wessels from South Africa?
Yeah,
I am familiar. It's been quite a while since I went over that material. Wessels was an Adventist in South Africa, and I tell you, the story is so faint in my mind right now that the glue, I'm 77 next month, and the glue doesn't stick up here like it used to. I'll tell you, though, if you write to Tim Poirier, P-O-I-R-I-E-R, it's a French name, but he is not French. Tim is the archivist of the White Estate. And God has blessed that man with a near photographic memory. When I was still employed there, I would saunter down to Tim's office in the vault, and I would say, Tim, I'm going to write a research paper on such and such a subject. Just mention it in passing and talk about something else and go back to my office. 30 minutes later, he'd come with a list of resources as long as your arm, saving me hours of research. That man has forgotten more about Ellen White than I ever do. He and Robert Olson. I consider Robert Olson, who now is 84 years of age and now has heart trouble in Loma Linda, California. He's not meeting very many public appointments anymore. Robert Olson, with the death of Arthur White back in the early 1990s, I consider Robert Olson the leading living authority on Ellen White, and Tim Poirier comes awful close. T-I-M, Tim, P-O-I-R-I-E-R. And his email address is poirierT, and then it's either at White Estate, no space in between, whiteestate.org, or at gc.adventist.org, O-R-G. Well, folks, we're 6 minutes over, but I want to thank you again for your interest. And if we don't meet again this side of the coming of Jesus, I hope we'll all get together for another visit on the other side. God bless you all. Let's have a prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for this marvelous gift that you've given to our church. Help us to treat it respectfully and to treat it diligently. Help us to be guided by it. Lord, help us to be guarded by it. And help us, Lord, to be saved because we heeded those counsels that you have given for us for today. We pray for the soon coming of our Lord and that we'll be ready to meet him with a song in our heart and a smile on our face. Lord, we pray for the rest of this camp meeting, the rest of today and tomorrow. We pray that you'll pour out your spirit in double portion upon the speakers tonight and tomorrow, all day tomorrow. May this camp meeting close in a mighty revival of primitive godliness on this campus. Pour out your spirit upon us, Lord. We're overdue for the latter rain of your Holy Spirit. And help us not to be part of the problem, but part of the solution in the finishing, not merely the furthering, Lord, but the finishing of your work in all the earth. And we thank you for that privilege. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.